I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Remembering President George H.W. Bush with Karen Hostler of the WIPR News Team. She covered the president, and she led the White House Correspondents Association during his time in office. They stayed in touch for years afterwards. Karen Hostler reflects on the Bush legacy. Plus, systemic racism and bias in American criminal justice. Matthew Horace spent 28 years in federal, state, and local law enforcement, including some time here in Baltimore. Ron Harris is a former reporter and editor with the Los Angeles Times. Their new book examines the roots of bias that undergird police misconduct. It's called The Black and the Blue: A Cop Reveals the Crimes, Racism, and Injustice in America's Law Enforcement. That's all coming up when Midday gets underway, right after these headlines. The list of young black men fatally shot by police is long. Recently, Jamel Roberson, a security guard at a bar near Chicago, and Emantic Bradford Jr., who was at a shopping mall in Alabama on Thanksgiving Day, were both shot dead by police by mistake. Last Friday, Amber Geiger, an officer in the Dallas Police Department, was indicted for murdering her neighbor, Botham Jean. She contends she thought she was entering her own apartment when she returned home from work. When she mistakenly entered Mr. Jean's apartment, she shot him. In a new book about law enforcement, race, and justice in America, former cop Matthew Horace presents an insider's view of police tactics and police culture. Horace worked in federal, state, and local law enforcement for 28 years, including more than two decades with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. He was based in Baltimore for a couple of those years, serving as an ATF violent crime supervisor. Ron Harris is the co-author of the new book. He's a former reporter and editor at the Los Angeles Times and at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. The book is called The Black and the Blue: A Cop Reveals the Crimes, Racism, and Injustice in America's Law Enforcement. Mr. Harris, Mr. Horace, welcome to you both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Mr. Horace, there was an incident back in 2017 in St. Louis. The officers were just indicted for their beating up a protester in St. Louis. They were protesting another act of police misconduct. And it turns out the gentleman they were beating up was an undercover police officer himself. You relate in this book a story in which you were in a very similar situation. You found yourself all of a sudden on the receiving end of a gun pointed to you by colleagues in the Providence Police Department. Can you tell us that story to begin our conversation?
Sure. Well, you know, we were doing an undercover operation in Providence, Rhode Island, where I was buying drugs and guns from suspects. And the operational planning had been done like it always was. The officers and federal agents that were supposed to be on site were there. They understood what I looked like. You know, one of the most important things in an undercover is to understand who the undercover is so that when things go bad or if things go awry, you know who to go rescue. In this case, everyone understood what I was wearing and how the deal was supposed to go down. After I'd given the arrest signal, I walked away. An officer out of nowhere came and put his gun in my face and started yelling and screaming to get down on the ground. And this officer was not present during the briefing. So this is another one of those things where, you know, things start to happen very quickly, and this officer mistakenly assumed that I was a bad guy instead of a good guy. And these situations do have tragic consequences at times.
Yeah, so when it comes to racial profiling, it is something that police officers are doing, both black and white police officers, and you were on the receiving end of that. I mean, what was his response when that officer found out who you were, that you were not one of the bad guys?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I responded very upset and very angry, so I don't really remember what his response. I remember people had to call me off, you know, because at that point. But, you know, the more interesting fact here is when I talk to people about doing undercover, especially federal agents in the different three-letter organizations, undercover is dangerous no matter how you look at it. But for African-American officers and agents that do it, there's that second level of danger that you run the risk of getting mistaken by a bad guy.
Yeah. And Ron Harris, this book is about, in a way, code switching, isn't it, from being part of the blue team of police officers and part of the community of black men in particular who appear to be targeted in so many cases by police departments across the country. This is not unique to St. Louis. It's not unique to Baltimore. You write a lot about the challenges that Mr. Horace and his colleagues face when it comes to being on both sides of this equation.
And I think that is one of the tough parts. We have a whole chapter called Being Black and Blue. And as Matt talks about, in that incident that happened to him, fortunately, he didn't get injured. But we had another situation right here in Prince George's County where an officer was killed. A similar situation in New York City. And officers all, I mean, not New York, yeah, New York City. And then you have other situations where officers are discriminated against. We've got situations out of St. Louis, Seattle. You see this across the nation. And in fact, one of the things that happened to Matt, we were talking about the profiling. It goes right back to what you're talking about in Birmingham and in outside of Chicago, where two men were shot doing good. When someone assumed that because they were black, they were wrong. And I think Matt can tell you, and at least I remember Matt, when Matt told me, he said, "Ron, I've been an officer for years, and I have the right to carry a gun openly." He said, "But me and my fellow officers would never do that." He said, "And the reason we don't, because there's going to be this thing that somebody's going to make a call and is going to say, black man with a gun. And that's going to put me at risk."
Yeah. And Mr. Horace, there are folks in the Baltimore Police Department that I've talked to over the years and in police departments across the country who assert that this is a situation of a few bad apples, that police departments are not systemically racist, they're not systemically biased, but that there's these few rogue cops who do this kind of behavior. You yourself write, "I've done some things I'm not proud of."
Sure.
Can you elaborate on what those things were, the nature of those things, and how that came to be? Because you were obviously part of this culture in which that was happening with more frequency than a lot of people want to believe.
Right. Well, I think there's the idea that by all means necessary, like when someone says, "We want this corner cleaned up," or "We want this neighborhood cleaned up," right? "And we want these people out of here." Whoever these people are, then you're leveraging the resources you have. You're going out, you're talking to potential bad guys, you're doing undercovers, you're crashing doors, and, you know, for all intents and purposes, you're kicking butt and taking names, right, for the sake of a greater good. But at the end of the day, what is that greater good, and who is impacted, and at what cost? If you look at what we did in the 80s and the 90s with the war on drugs in city after city, even though we were having small successes, seemingly small successes, over the course of time, nothing really changed. And many of these cities are in worse conditions now than they were then. So again, at what cost and at what extent do we do what it is we do?
Yeah, because towards the end of the book, Mr. Harris, you all write that the wrongs inside police departments are not about a handful of bad police officers. Instead, they reflect bad policing procedures and policies that many of our departments have come to accept as gospel. So this is something that many police departments across the United States are grappling with, and it's a problem of their own invention.
That is one of the things that we really want to drive home, is that it's not even that in some cases they are bad police officers, but the policies, the practices, the way they do business causes police to do things that are wrong. For instance, one of the things that we heard over and over and over again is the quote-unquote thin blue line. It causes officers not to report when a fellow officer does something wrong. Even though you know that officer was doing something wrong, you can't rat that officer out. You can't. So you are working against the public. It's in the public's best interest. It's in even the police department's best interest to get rid of bad actors. But we have a practice that's baked into the system. I think we call it a toxic brotherhood. I think Matt came up with that term. It's a toxic brotherhood. And we saw that nowhere more so than in, of all places, Chicago. Chicago, we ended up with 3 chapters on Chicago because its practice of covering up for police had gone on for so many decades that it resulted at one point. It had resulted in so many forced confessions that the governor of the state of Illinois suspended all death penalty executions. And he suspended them because they had coerced so many people into false confessions that he didn't know who was right. He didn't know who had really committed the crime, who had really committed the murder. So he suspended him.
And Mr. Horace, you all interviewed close to 100 law enforcement professionals, plus elected officials, community advocates, and people who were victims of police shootings. It's not just the police. One of your points is that the systemic nature of this begins with county councils and mayors and county commissions. You make the example of Ferguson, Missouri. Of course, we all know about what happened there with the shooting in 2014 of Michael Brown and the subsequent protests. But prior to that in Ferguson, Missouri, they were funding the town by issuing traffic citations.
Right. Well, there's that issue of organizations that use, laws to create revenue for their towns. And that was happening in a very abhorrent sense in Ferguson and in other jurisdictions, both in St. Louis County and throughout the United States. So when you have these laws like manner while walking or not putting your trash cans out the right way, you know, we found out in Ferguson that a large percentage of people in that region had fines and warrants on them for things like traffic violations or minor infractions. And this creates an environment where people are afraid to vote. People are afraid for their voices to be heard. And in many cases, you have police officers enforcing things for the sake of revenue, not for the sake of public safety.
And quotas about number of tickets that you issue and that kind of stuff are commonplace.
Yes.
And what was important about Ferguson, again, we were saying that it's not all bad, but not just about cops. Some of those cops didn't like to do that, but their jobs depended on it. And the department made it very clear to them that if you did not hand out enough tickets, you will be fired.
When it comes to changing that culture, then, how do you get to the point when, for example, as Mr. Harris says, so many police officers reluctant to report misconduct or unconstitutional policing on behalf of their colleagues, because you do that, you're ostracized by that colleague and perhaps others. People are worried about their capacity for promotions if you've done that, if you're a troublemaker and you have that reputation. How does that turn around?
Well, it starts with leadership, and I think we use as an example the superintendent in New Orleans, commissioner of police down there. They started more or less an incentive program. Because when things happen, the question is always asked, what did you know? When did you know? Who did you tell? And what did you do? If you look at a case like in Chicago with Laquan McDonald, so if you get past the idea that Officer Van Dyke was wrong in his action in terms of using excessive force, then you go back to the five other officers who told the same story that he did. So you had a culture there. One incident, one civilian's dead, one police officer shoots, and five people support his story, and it was all a lie. So it takes leadership at the top. It takes establishing a culture, right, of integrity from the bottom up and top down, and there has to be incentive for officers to understand, I have to do the right thing.
And what's the role, then, of people outside of the police department? I'm thinking about Baltimore, for example, here with Mayor Pugh in the process of hiring a new police commissioner, would be the fourth one who's been on, in that position this year. I mean, it's just unbelievable. I mean, it's not just the cops. Right.
No,
I
agree with you 100%. I'm looking at the cases down in Birmingham and in outside of Chicago. Everybody wants to go out and kind of hang these two police officers. And I'm not saying that not without fault. However, but this system has been going on for a while. So it is part of all of our responsibility as citizens. And it's really, we have to look at our elected officials. It's the mayor. City council member, our city council member that represents us in our particular district. Those people are the people that really have to be held accountable. And then that pushes it down below. Because, as we point out in the book, all of the orders that really police officers do, when police officers say, we're going to concentrate in this neighborhood, the police don't make up their own rules. That comes from elected officials, comes from citizens. It comes from someone that says, we want this area policed.
So we're talking about civilian oversight then, you know?
And well, that's it's always civilian oversight. It's just that when we don't do that, people talk about civilian boards, and I don't say that that's not necessary. However, we have civilians in place now, and there has to be greater civilian involvement.
Matthew Horace and Ron Harris, their new book is called The Black and the Blue, A Cop reveals the crimes, racism, and injustice in America's law enforcement. Matthew Horace and Ron Harris will be talking about the book tomorrow night at 6:30 at the Enoch Pratt Central Library. If you'd like to talk to them right now, when we come back from a break, you are welcome to join our conversation. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, it's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. We'll be joined by Dr. Beverly Mitchell ahead of her lecture in Baltimore on white supremacy, power, and the role of interfaith engagement. That's an event sponsored by the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies. It's coming up next week. We'll also talk about arts criticism in Baltimore, Tim Smith and Wesley Case, the two critics who covered and reviewed the Popular and Fine Arts for the Baltimore Sun, have left the paper. So what does that mean for arts coverage and interest in the arts here in Charm City? That's all coming up on Midday Culture Connections tomorrow. If you're just joining us today, we're talking with the authors of a new book on race and justice in America. It's called The Black and the Blue: A Cop Reveals the Crimes, Racism, and Injustice in America's Law Enforcement. Matthew Horace worked in law enforcement for 28 years. He's a contributor to The Wall Street Journal and CNN, and he teaches courses on terrorism, law enforcement, and crisis management at Farley Dickinson University. Ron Harris is an adjunct journalism professor at Howard University and a former journalist at the Los Angeles Times and the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. You are welcome to join our conversation with Mr. Harris and Mr. Horace. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. To follow me on Twitter, that's always a swell idea as far as I'm concerned. It's @TomHallWYPR. And if you want to catch us on the WYPR Facebook page, you're welcome to do that as well. We are streaming our conversation. So, Matt Horace, you write that if ever there was a place in America that epitomized the idea that black lives don't matter, it is Baltimore, by every measure of well-being. Part of the 28 years you spent in law enforcement was spent here. Baltimore Police Department is under a consent decree with the Department of Justice to reform its procedures and practices. What's the key to this consent decree being successful here and elsewhere? Because there are a number of departments currently under consent decrees across the country.
Well, I think it starts at the very top. Baltimore has a new police commissioner. They have to
work,
not quite yet, work to change the culture of the organization and go through every single aspect of that consent decree, determine what has to be accomplished, and assign people to get it accomplished so you don't find yourself 5 years in still under that same decree or another one, for that matter.
When you say it starts at the top, I wonder what that means. I mean, we just had this incredible trial where 8 members of the Baltimore Police Department, who were part of a gun trace task force, mm-hmm. were convicted of running a huge criminal enterprise. They were shaking down drug dealers. They were stealing money. They were just acting illegally in every way. Yet all of the people at the top, at least, you know, the command staff, not just the chief of police, the commissioner, but the people below him and the people below them, they seem to be completely oblivious. I mean, this went on for years, right under the noses of the people who are commanding. I mean, what does that say about the cluelessness of the command structure in a department like the Baltimore Police Department?
Well, it's dysfunction at every level. You know, command organizations are done that way to give accountability, to have management controls in place, and to have systems of checks and balances. And in this case, this not only reflects on the officers who were indicted, but it reflects on the officers above them at every level. So this requires, in many cases, wholesale organizational change in police organizations.
One of the departments you write about, Ron Harris, is the Arlington Police Department, which in Arlington, Virginia, which requires that police officers have college degrees. I spoke with Kevin Davis, who was two police commissioners
ago.
Right,
I remember. Doesn't seem that long, does it?
Right. And he was fired by Mayor Pugh. Commissioner D'Souza was brought in, and he didn't last too long. He had tax problems, and so now Commissioner Tuggle is the interim commissioner, and we're in the search for a new commissioner who's currently being vetted by the city council and others. But issue that Mr. Davis talked about was that he said the average age of police officers in Baltimore is something like 25, that these are young men and women, and their life experience is not particularly substantial, and that's a real problem when they're encountering citizens on the street, just even if they're not in tense situations, but just regular situations.
You know, that's very true. Matt and I have had a lot of conversations about this because Matt worked in that department that you're talking about in Arlington where they required a college degree. And he's seen, and as we did research, we've seen a difference in the level of professionalism and the ability to talk to people and to talk people in and out of situations, to kind of go through a sense of examination and reflection and make the right moves. Matt talks about, we talk about one thing early in the book, where Matt had to go to a domestic violence situation, and there was one perception, and he looked up and he was facing a guy who was 300 pounds and 6'8", and the guy was being a little belligerent, and Matt for a minute thought he was going to have to go to his gun, but by talking, walking through it, it got close. But next thing you know, the guys are coming downstairs and going into handcuffs. His ego and his, testosterone didn't get the best of him. But let me just say one little thing real quickly. Even though these problems we talk about in police departments, they're not just about race. They're about race, but they're about culture. Because if you look at the Baltimore Police Department and talking about the top, I think they've had six, close to nine African-American commissioners. And yet, in Baltimore, when they did the following Freddie Gray, and when they looked at the police department, which was 42% black, had a black police chief at the time, had a black mayor at the time, the leadership, the relationship with the African-American community. Even though African-Americans were at the top, there was a system and a practice that went on within this department as it does with other departments around the country.
And Matt Horace, Joel Fitzgerald is currently the commissioner in Fort Worth of the Fort Worth Police Department. He is now the candidate that has been proposed by the mayor. As I mentioned, the city council is currently vetting him. The mayor says that her office and the Department of Legal Affairs with the city has done a vetting job on Mr. Fitzgerald, unlike any vetting job that's been done before, given the prior troubles they've had with vetting. Do you know Mr. Fitzgerald?
I do not. I do not.
What's your advice for him if, in fact, he is confirmed by the city council next month?
Well, like for any leader at that level, to get in and determine where your problems lie and whose people, which individuals and command staff people are on board and which aren't, and make the necessary changes you need to make immediately, and don't wait and don't delay. Once you've determined what the issues are, act and act quickly.
Tom, as you know, we looked at New Orleans, which was in a really bad situation.
Mm-hmm.
And the police chief that went in there, Chief Pennington, went in and he fired, I think, one-third of the whole department. They either forced him out, and then he built from it from there. And, you know, looking at what you said at the leadership level here in Baltimore, it's a disaster to be Matt's kinder than probably I am. Because you're right. How could all of this go on and the department not know about it? And most significantly, most recently, now everybody saw the video of a African-American police officer beating this guy, he and his partner, beating a guy. The video went across the country. You know, with all of that, with all that other publicity, with Freddie Gray and the officers being charged and finally convicted, why would any
officer... Well, none of the officers in Freddie Gray's case were convicted.
No. I'm talking about in the case of the guys who were running a drug...
Oh, the gun trace task force.
Yeah, gun trace task force. In that case, how does an officer act like that? Because there is a culture. And as Matt likes to say, you know, culture beats strategy, eat strategy for lunch.
The Black and the Blue, that's the name of the book. A cop reveals the crimes, racism, and injustice in America's law enforcement. I'm Tom Hall. My guests are Matthew Horace and Ron Harris, the co-authors of the book. Mr. Horace spent 28 years in law enforcement, including several here in Baltimore. Now, there are a number of Black activists, community organizers and activists here in Baltimore who have suggested firing everyone on the Baltimore Police Department, like literally starting from scratch. So you use the example of the commissioner in New Orleans. On the other hand, hiring police officers is turning out to be a whole lot harder than maybe a lot of people understood. The mayor, Commissioner Davis, Commissioner D'Souza, others before them have said, we are understaffed. We don't have enough officers to fill the positions that we have. But just last week, Doug Donovan of the Baltimore Sun reporting that they are well below their goal of hiring 25 officers a month. They wanted to try to hire 25 folks to the force every month. They're at like 12 or 13. They can't keep up with the goals that they've made. What's the key for a Mr. Fitzgerald or whoever ends up being the commissioner to attract people to the police department as a career? Is it just money? What is it?
Well, just so you know, this is not only a problem that Baltimore faces. Hiring and recruitment is the number one issue in police agencies around the United States. But many departments have found doing things like national recruiting, having incentive programs, being flexible on your requirements. You know, we talked earlier about some departments have degree requirements. Well, when you do that, you limit your pool. And then some departments have residency requirements. When you do that, you limit your pool. Some departments say you have to be 24. Well, when you do that, you limit your pool. So look at where you are, what you need, what your requirements are, and sometimes expand those requirements out to meet what it is you're looking for. And, you know, it's a very, very difficult job. Every department in America is facing the same challenge.
Matthew Horace and Ron Harris. The new book is called The Black and the Blue, A Cop Reveals the Crimes, Racism, and Injustice in America's Law Enforcement. To be part of our conversation when we come back from a break, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. Before we go to a break, on Mondays here on Midday, it's our practice to read the names of the people who've lost their lives to violence in the previous week. We do so to stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their family and friends in their hour of grief. We get their names from Ellen Worthing, who has compiled a list of Baltimore homicide victims going back 17 years. We also consult the Baltimore Sun's list of homicides and victim identifications that are posted on the Baltimore Police Department's Facebook page. So far in the year 2018, 286 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. Last week, police reported 6 victims of homicide in our city. The name of one of those people has not yet been released. The other 5 victims are Marlon Gamble, age 35, Alexander Anderson, age 49, Garnell Fulton, age 39, Murfeg Hussein, age 61, and Tyron Dansbury. He was 37 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It is, in fact, Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking with Matthew Horace and Ron Harris. While a lot of attention has been focused on the troubled relationship between communities of color and law enforcement, their new book takes up an often overlooked dimension of that dynamic. It's what Horace and Harris call the dichotomy, the fragility, and even the peculiar dangers of being an African-American law enforcement officer. The book is called The Black and the the Blue, a cop reveals the crimes, racism, and injustice in America's law enforcement. Matthew Horace and Ron Harris will be in conversation about the book tomorrow night at the Enoch Pratt Central Library here in Baltimore. If you'd like to pose a question or if you have a comment for them today, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can send us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR, and you can ping us on Facebook. We are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. Gentlemen, we have an email from a listener, Stephanie, who says, whenever I hear about these incidents, the first question that occurs to me is, what did that person do that warrants the death penalty? There was an incident some years ago in Baltimore County in Randallstown. Some boys, all 18, under 18, were out pranking. They were throwing stones at the doors of houses in their neighborhood. And one of those doors happened to belong to a Baltimore County police officer. He came out of his house and gave chase. Two of the boys got away, but he caught one. He put him in a chokehold, and the boy died. The cop went on trial and was acquitted. Did the boys deserve to be held accountable for their activity? Yes. Did any of them deserve the death penalty? That is what these cops are doling out. They are acting as judge, jury, and executioner on the streets of our city. Mr. Horace, you hear this sentiment a lot. How do you respond to Stephanie when it comes to this impression? Because the stories of people being shot who are unarmed, who were being stopped at for a traffic incident or were mistaken identity, or something, there's a constant flow of them. How do you respond to emailers like Stephanie?
Well, we go back to what Ron was talking about earlier, that there is a system and a culture within the criminal justice system that says, basically, in many cases, we don't convict cops, right? And in a situation like this, all right, so you look at all the facts of what she describes. So you have the act. You have the incident with the children throwing rocks at houses. Then you have the response from the police officer. And then you have someone dying. No one needed to die over that incident. But what is the consequence? And what did the jury think? What did the prosecutor think? What does the defense attorney think? You mean you got all those people running down the same road that the cop did no wrong and this kid deserves to die, right? So it's not just the police officer's act. A jury heard it. A judge presided over it. A prosecutor moved forward or didn't. There's a whole slew of people who are responsible, and I think sometimes we lose sight of that.
That's really ironic because I had a friend, a white friend of mine, and he said, you know, Ron, until I saw the shooting of Walter Scott in in South Carolina, where a black man got shot in the back by a police officer. He didn't have a gun. He was running away. And the cop tried to cover it up. He said, I always believed in those incidents that the victim did something. He said, that was the first time I said, oh, my God, that guy did nothing. And he said, I began to finally question all of these other incidents.
You write that the goal of every law enforcement confrontation is that a citizen should be given to gain compliance. You want to gain compliance in a situation that is safe for that person and safe for the officer. So the first step is to establish presence. The next is verbalization. The next is empty hand control, and then intermediate force. Talk us through that, Mr. Horace. And is that something that can be addressed in the training of police officers when they join the force?
Well, what you described is what we call the use of force continuum. And that's what takes us from that very first point when you have interaction with someone all the way up to the time when you have to maybe use some sort of force. It can be, and it is trained. The challenges you have with the use of force continuum is that things can happen in 2 seconds, or things can draw out and happen over a minute or 3 minutes, or and in some cases in a negotiation, right? We look at hostage negotiations. So there is no standard that says it must happen this way. It's a judgment call that we make when we're on the scene and involved. But in many of these cases, things go from 1 to 20 in a second. And in some cases, things go from 1 to death in 3 seconds or 10 seconds or 20 seconds. So I think the matter is we have to be mindful in the way we speak to people and evaluate situations.
Yeah.
But another part of that is the perception. And that's one of the reasons that, and we talk about this in the first chapter of the book, and is how African-American men are perceived as the boogeyman. And that's why you have these cases, for instance, in Birmingham and then right outside of Chicago, where guys who are actually doing good, they were the good guy with the gun, as the NRA likes to say. They're dead. Because the perception was, immediately, we saw a black man with a gun. In Chicago, outside of Chicago, this guy had saved people. by securing the gunman, holding the gunman to the ground, who had already shot.
He was the security guard at
this
bar.
Right. And he's dead.
And how about this concealed carry dimension? I mean, Mr. Bradford, a Mantic Bradford, who was at the shopping mall in Alabama, he had a legally registered gun on his possession, on his person. And then when this incident, when someone started shooting in the mall, he took the gun out. And that was one of the reasons that the officer who shot him thought that he might be the perpetrator. I do know that, you know, overall, police departments across the country are against concealed carry legislation. But how do you think that from what you know of that incident and from what you know of this law, and now that it's been in effect in many states for some years, how does that affect the dynamic between police and the public?
Well, let's be clear about the incident in Alabama. He wasn't the only one who had a concealed weapon, and he wasn't the only one who drew his gun when he heard gunfire. He was the only one who was shot and killed. So then we get back to that. What is in our subconscious that says this person is more dangerous than that person? Certainly in Alabama, with concealed weapons and open carry permits in certain places, something like this happens. People draw their gun. That's what's going to happen. But why was he the only one who was shot dead? And I think that's the question that we should all be still asking ourselves.
I actually think, Matt, it goes back to what you said, is that, look, I know I don't want to be, even though I am legally allowed to do that, I don't want to walk around with a weapon on my...
As a police officer, you're writing, I'm not going to walk into a store with a gun, even though you're a police officer, because you think that it could raise suspicion.
Well, let's take it one step further. Most of the African-American law enforcement folks who I know and closely, we all have to take that second guess before we get involved with something when we're off duty, because we know through history and experience that our actions could be misinterpreted and it could end up in death.
Ron Harris, can this problem be addressed by training our way out of it? Can police officers be trained?
I think training is a big part. It's two things. I think it's who do you recruitment, and I think Matt, you'll agree with this. Recruitment is a huge issue. We had an issue down in very quickly in New Orleans. They recruited a young woman. The psychiatrist said, do not hire this woman. The psychologist said, do not hire this woman. They hired her anyway, and what did she end up doing? She massacred her family and killed a fellow police officer. So recruitment is one big part of it. Training is another part of it. And that's, I think, it's a huge element that's missing now. A lot of police forces will say, we don't have the money to do the training, but there's different kinds of training that you can do, cultural training, and it's more than just going to an African-American museum at the Smithsonian in D.C. It's a lot more than that.
I want to go to David in Columbia. David, we are almost out of time. If you could ask your question real quickly, we'd appreciate that. Welcome to Midday.
Thank you. Just on the Thin Blue Line issue, other industries and organizations like medicine and aircraft maintenance have put in place mechanisms for anonymously reporting problem people in their organizations. Has that been considered for policing?
All right, Matt Horace, real quick, as a final word.
I am familiar with certain police agencies that do have those sort of programs in place and do use them.
It's a great idea because the airline industry has seen a huge drop in fatal mishaps because of that practice.
Matthew Horace worked in law enforcement for 28 years, including more than two decades with the ATF. Ron Harris is a former reporter and editor with the Los Angeles Times and the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Their book is called The Black and the Blue, A Cop Reveals the Crimes, Racism, and Injustice in America's Law Enforcement. I was compelled by this book, gentlemen, and I appreciate you guys coming by this afternoon.
Thank you so much
for having us.
Matthew Horace and Ron Harris will be talking about their book at the Enoch Pratt Central Library tomorrow night right here in Baltimore. It starts at 6:30 in the afternoon. African American Department. It's part of the library's Brown Lecture Series. We've got more information and links to it on our website, wypr.org/midday. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. We'll be joined by Dr. Beverly Mitchell of the Wesley Theological Seminary for a conversation about the lineage between anti-Semitism and racism. Dr. Mitchell is giving a talk in Baltimore next week on white supremacy, power, and the role of interfaith engagement. We'll talk to her tomorrow, and as well, we're going to talk about the paucity of arts coverage in local media now that two of the big critics for the Baltimore Sun are no longer with the paper. That's coming up tomorrow. tomorrow on Midday. We want to thank the Diz for supplying lunch today. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekends. You can find them on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. Coming up, a special from NPR, Hanukkah Lights, is up next after a break for the news. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.